one did and said it looked like this good idea should be expanded to include municipal judges and municipal courts, and I didn't know whether there'd been any contact to add a friendly amendment to it, but if they didn't get a hold of you, I'll not press the matter, I'll go back and...
Well, I think you ought to, well, next time we have Bill Linden here, you ought to ask him about it, because they're also, they're still judges in courts, and they still have discipline through the Judicial Fitness Commission, which is probably more appropriate than what we have here.
I tried to refer it to their association, instead of coming from one court, from the whole association.
Anyway, in fact, we couldn't really do it here, because the relating clause is different. It says relating to justices of peace. So, unless they want to be demoted to...
Oh, whoa.
Be called, supposedly.
Maybe it's a promotion.
Promotion? I don't know how judges see these things, but I know that it's pretty stratified. Anyway,
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
When these justices of peace attend these programs, what are the payment arrangements? Is that established under ORS 1.850 or some other place so that that's all taken care of?
Senator, it's my understanding that there's a line item in the court administrator or in the Chief Justice's budget which provides somewhere around $25,000 for the training.
And, well, when they attend one of these, are they paid mileage and are they paid per diem? How does that work?
I don't know, Senator.
You might get on the phone and ask them, but at least...
Well, isn't set out in some other statute or some other place? We don't want to be... We wouldn't want this to create a boondoggle, for instance, where they compensate...
I think the most important issue is, in fact, that they get some training.
Yeah, I agree.
Never mind the boondoggle. We have, in fact, people who, you know, were non-lawyers who were doing this work. Who need to have some basic training, and I think it's probably in our best interest that we move ahead and make sure that they get some credit for the training that they do get. And so,
actually, it's my understanding that the first training session is going to be in Honolulu in December.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was a guy.
And Senator Brockman is going along to be the appropriate escort.
Just to make sure it's not a boondoggle.
Right.
Reno, that's where the judge is going to get trained. Right?
Okay.
Madam Chair, do you want a motion to move this amendment?
I certainly do.
I'll give it.
Senator Brenneman has moved the amendment dated May 15th, the Weber amendments. Are there objections to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
No, I'll move the bill to the floor to do pass.
Okay, good. Senator Brenneman moves Senate Bill 413 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please, Andrea.
Senator Brenneman.
Aye.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Brenneman.
Aye.
Senator Hill.
Aye.
Senator
Schumann. Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Chair Collins.
Aye. Motion carried. Senator Brockman will carry this bill. Please. And then, be careful. Someone will ask whether this is a boondoggle or not. Let's move to Senate Bill 697, which is back again. The chair and Catherine and Senator Kenemer and Kenemer's staff and everybody else we can figure out down in Legislative Council has been working on this bill, and we are at a... I guess we need your help. We have a couple of choices, folks.
Put the paddles out.
And a chart to the choices.
And a chart to the choices on this bill.
A chart.
It is probably one of the most, we thought was a simple little matter to see if people who are driving while they have uninsured, while they're uninsured, can, we can figure out a way to get them through community service, to do some additional community service, and we continue to run into the Brown versus Multnomah case, which causes ultimate of indigent defense costs. And then we run into the way all the municipal court judges have been operating with the kind of infractions they now have this term, which is a Class B traffic infraction at the moment, which means, I think, that they just send out a ticket. An A infraction has some greater consequence, but probably still crosses the line. And so I'll let Catherine explain what we think maybe the minimalist approach is, and what, if we want to be a little more adventurous, we can call it a Class A infraction. But I'll turn it over to Catherine.
First of all, I wanted to call your attention to the fact we did vote this bill out of committee once and brought it back. It has the -1 amendment still attached to it. So we'll need to take action if we don't want the -1. In front of you have an explanation. The -1 were the ones that deleted the classification as an infraction. It changed shall to may, which they all do, and provided for 160 hours of community service and a $5,000 fine. I think that gets us close to the line, or probably crosses the line of brown. The next one is the -2 amendments, which are probably next in order of seriousness or consequences. They restore the classification as an infraction and change it from a B to an A. And in your packet you have a list, there are two things in your packet you might want to take a look at. One is the infraction procedures and the penalties, and the other is a copy of the ORS.
Okay,
which
packet
talk about
meetings in our files.
Yes, Senator.
Okay. It would be in your files here. Okay.
Okay. And the other one is the community service statute. Okay. -2 changes it to a Class A infraction, continues to have the shell to a may. It provides for up to 150 hours of community service, a $500 fine, and then has notwithstanding language, which is to get around the community service provisions that are already in the statutes, which require a lower number of hours. The 150 hours we got by taking the $500 fine and using a minimum wage, and it came up to 150 hours.
I didn't mention.
Yes, please.
I didn't hear who was proposing the three sets of amendments.
They're all from me or us.
Us.
Us meaning collectively. Kenimer and I just sort of both threw up our hands and say, well, let's just take it to the committee and let them decide.
Oh, gosh. We might be here all day if we
Well, no, we won't be here all day because we've got to make a decision on that. And he doesn't have any stronger recommendation than I do. It's a question of...
Well, as long as it's discretionary, and so I think it's a very serious situation. The only thing that might be improved is if the victim were to be the recipient of the service and maybe give them to mow their lawn or something at least in some circumstances. But I would be in favor of the -1 if it's passable on committee.
Well, we really can't do -1.
Madam Chair?
Oh, you
yes.
can.
Senator Grinsky, not, no.
Perhaps
we're
I'm missing, missing a point here. The problem, the indigent defense costs, is that what this was all
the
about?
The problem is indigent defense costs, yes, and the whole changing the entire way that the municipal courts run their business with respect to these kind of things.
Okay. Well, that being the case, what does each of these amendments do on that? I mean, I can see what they are, but
well,
is there a line
get,
that gets crossed somewhere?
We
here?
Need to go back to,
so, two or
to
three.
Catherine. Yes, the line, we think two will probably get you. You can probably increase the penalty that much, right?
Yes, Senator. Every -3 are the safest. There's no, probably not much risk with -3. -2, there's probably maybe a 25% risk that they'll run into some problems. It's not, it's also a right to a jury trial. There's a number of things under Brown that attach
it's
it.
Not
and you're just kind of basically moving closer up the line. I think it's probably anybody's guess.
So
depends on how conservative a risk-taking you want to be.
And I guess it is now currently with the -3. I don't know if you want to go through the -3 amendments as a comparison, or whether people can read the chart and understand exactly what it is. The only thing we're changing with the -3 then, Catherine, is what?
The dash three makes it a B. It reduces the number of hours to 48 hours.
Excuse me, it doesn't make it a B. It leaves it a B.
I'm sorry, it leaves it a B, right. Restores the B language, which is currently what the violation of that section is. And with that, it brings up to a $250 fine. We put in some notwithstanding language because the community service provisions specify not more than 48 hours. I suppose the notwithstanding isn't necessarily necessary there.
Okay, well.
And it also specifies that the party must consent to community service.
1 and 3?
That's already in the current community service statute. If you look at ORS 137-170, which is replicated for you, actually
one, two,
it's in
one,
128,
yeah,
partway down the line there. Prior to such an order of community service, the offender must consent to donate labor for the welfare of the public. And we tried to find out if that was constitutionally necessary or where it came from, and legislative counsel told me it was quite a large research project to find out why it would require quite a number of hours.
Senator Gransky.
Presently, if you're cited for driving uninsured, what's the fine and the community service requirement, if any?
Kind of like giving them the
it's a Class B infraction.
Right.
The fine would be up to $250. And the community service time for a violation or traffic offense, except a major traffic offense, not more than 48 hours.
Great.
So 3 doesn't do anything different.
Very little.
Huh? Well, how's it different then?
I don't think. It really isn't. It just lays out in the statute for anybody who wants to. That's why it's the safest alternative.
I see.
One of the reasons.
Then let me just clarify something in my mind here. The dash ones and the dash twos, are we messing around with that business about the party must give consent? I mean, are we eliminating that in the dash ones and the dash twos?
No, because you're referring back to the original statute.
That's what I was afraid of.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that we're wasting our time unless we at least go with the Second Amendment. So
I think you're right.
Why don't we move? I'd move the Weber 2 amendments, I guess, to Senate Bill 697.
Senator Gransky has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 697 for the discussion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Springer.
I assume that means we're undoing the dash 1 amendments.
Oh, yes, that's the chair's, Senator Gransky has moved to substitute the dash 2 amendments, for what we adopted as dash 1. Are there objections to Senator Grinsky's motion?
I have a question. Why do we go with 150 instead of 160 when we have, does this make it not quite a major traffic offense?
Well, the difference is, apparently they take Class A infraction is a $500 fine, and the courts construe some of this to look at minimum wage, and so the 150 brings you to be an equivalent of the $500 fine. What we run into is people say the courts have interpreted the fact that you can't impose community service beyond the fine if it's more, and they use a minimum wage to calculate the time you put in, et cetera, in terms of what that is to me. Isn't it? And correct me if I'm wrong, Catherine.
Yes.
We changed the minimum wage though.
Well, maybe we did.
Well,
it's rounded out. I mean,
that's why it's 150.
And that's why you need the notwithstanding language there, because in the community service it would have been 48 hours for that type of a violation.
Okay. Are there objections to Senator Grinsky's motion to move to substitute dash 2 amendments on Senate Bill 697? Hearing done, so ordered. Jack's going to make a comment now. Five what?
I was just going to say the courts generally, in practice, rounded out to $5, so it's not really specifically tied to the minimum wage. It's just close to it.
Well, the chair is not particularly interested in moving it down to 120 or whatever at the moment, but we'll put a maximum, depending on the judge. Senator Grinsky?
I was looking at the hand engrossed dash two, which allows the judge to order up to 150 hours.
That's true.
I look at the dash two amendment, and it doesn't say up to. It just says maybe sentenced to perform 150 hours of community service work.
That's an error, Senator. When I hand engrossed it, I noted it, and
okay.
I didn't go back and do it.
Thank you
for bringing it to my attention.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 697 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we consider this a real challenge to try and carry this successfully on the floor.
I'm missing a Kenner. I deal with it.
We'll see. Senator Gretzky moves Senate Bill 697 as amended to the floor and with the correction noted on line 5 of the Hannah Gross piece. Call the roll, please, Andre.
Senator Brennan. Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Gretzky.
Aye.
Senator
Hill. Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Chair
Collins. Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Well, I think, Senator Gretzky, can you check in and find out whether Kenner really, truly wants to carry this or whether you can carry
I'll
it?
I'll ask
we'll,
him.
We'll give it to you for now, right?
I consider it an honor.
That'll be a challenge.
Right.
If you can carry it on
yes.
the floor.
I would try. I would hold my head high.
Good. Okay, let's move to Senate Bill 627 in a work session on, and this is probably,
it's back.
The chair has been in some negotiations with Senator Hanmey and with the psychiatrists and any number of people, and I will have some. Catherine, we're passing out dash seven amendments. Yes. And no, I don't want dash five at the moment. If the committee wants to go back to dash five,
no, both
I understand
okay.
that. I would okay. like your. To move through this as we can. I spent the weekend trying to get the dash seven amendments back into a coordination of understanding the relationship of this dash seven amendments to the original bill. And as of this morning, I had failed. But I do have some recommendations. And I would call up Dennis Eckinger from the Lane County, he's a psychologist from Lane County, who's been working part of the work group. And before we get too far, I want to share with the committee the chair's recommendations. And that would be on the dash seven amendments that we delete section five. And that we also delete section 7. And I'll give you my rationale. That will leave current law the way it is with respect to the balance or imbalance between the physician's right or the psychiatrist's right to discharge versus the investigator's community mental health person's right to discharge, et cetera, from the hospital. We have dash five amendments, if you want to get into that, which has not been able to come to agreement between the various parties. The psychiatrists and certain other people who work in the institutions and manage the hospitals have their dash five amendments, which deal with those sections, and the ones in 627-7 deal with those, and it would be my wish at this point to rather than try to continue to fuss around with those two differences when we looking at probable cause to believe is dangerous, changing the psychiatrist standard and a few other kinds of things that we haven't had enough debate and testimony for the committee. So I would ask that we delete 5 and 7 before we proceed, sections 5 and 7, unless the committee wants to charge ahead, and then we'll have to spend more time with them. Senator Springer.
Well, Madam Chair, I think when this was first up, I expressed some reluctance to do much to the bill that we had spent a lot of time on, I think you know, last session on civil commitment. And I think basically what you've outlined is pretty consistent with that concern. It seems to me we've got another bill that is getting a lot of attention over on the House side that deals with firearms and also speaks to the issue of folks who may be under certain disabilities and their eligibility. And I just want to make sure we're not kind of proceeding across purposes with what
I would say to you that both the Dash 7 now deletes firearms entirely. So as it comes to you, Dash 7 does not deal with firearms. Is that correct, Dennis?
That's correct.
And if you'll just list your name for the record. So
yes, my name is Dennis E. Conger.
Right, thank you. Now, I'd like to go through Dash 7 then for a moment. And Section 2, as I read it, does allow voluntary commitment to certain of the state hospitals upon examination by a physician and some resolution that in fact they ought to be committed. And I think that is an improvement over what we have now. And I guess, Dennis, would you say for the record that the Mental Health Division, et cetera, have signed off on Section 2?
To my knowledge, that's correct. They were at the work session and they agreed to the language as written here.
Madam Chair?
Senator Grinsky.
People can't be voluntarily committed at the present time?
Into the state hospital, that's true.
Is that right?
Right, to the state hospital system. There is one state hospital that does allow voluntary admissions to a catchment area. The rest of them do not.
And I do believe that this is where we had fiscal impact of several million of dollars, like $7 million or something. And
correct.
The revised Section 2 will hopefully get us to a smaller fiscal impact.
It remarkably changes that. There was language that said right to least restrictive treatment, which was the real problem for the Mental Health Division.
Okay. Senator Springer.
Well, I'm clear, I think the policy or the way things are happening now, it's not because the law prohibits admission, but it's because there's not the money there. If a person walked up to Damish and said, hey, I want to be admitted, there's no law that says they can't be admitted, but they just won't do it because they don't have the money. That's my understanding.
That's correct. What it does is that it puts the communities in an awkward bind, and in particular, it puts the judge at the time of a hearing, the way we've written it here, in an awkward bind of having somebody who is committable but is willing to go to the hospital voluntarily. It's forcing that judge in some instances to, frankly, kind of run roughshod over really, I would at least say probably the rights of that individual and saying, well, we'll commit you to the hospital just to get you in. And that seems to be somewhat of an injustice. That's why we wanted at least it to be stated in language that if they get to that point, if they're brought to a hearing and they're found committable but are found also willing and able to participate in voluntary care, that they should be admitted. It's a fairly small number in actuality, and we're attempting to really kind of unravel what the courts are having to grapple with at this point, and they feel, I think, uncomfortable in doing what they're doing.
Okay, I think that's, we can, Senator Springer, you have objections to this part of Section 2 at this point, you think?
Oh, no, I think it seems, however, that if a person has been committed, then we're asking that person be examined again, and conceivably,
they're not being committed.
No.
They're being brought to a commitment hearing, but the statute, as it's written, says that if an individual is willing and able to participate in voluntary care, that they shall not be committed. But to get them into the hospital rather than discharge them from the court, quite ill, the courts in there, and the patient is saying, well, if that's what I have to do, I want to get into the hospital, I need that care, they're going along with being committed just to get that to happen. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
Okay. Thanks.
Section three then says that within previous years, though, I think the material difference there is that you, it doesn't have to be a state hospital, it can be any other hospital, and people who are from the mental health family advocates felt this was an important change.
It was also supported by the Attorney General's office. They wanted this language changed as well.
Madam Chair, just a question on that. As I read the definition of facility, that word includes a state mental hospital.
Right.
As well as community hospital.
Right.
Do we want to continue to make a distinction?
Yes.
It would be a placement under commitment under 060, which could be either to an approved hospital or the state hospital. Simply having it the state hospital, it was felt by the Attorney General's office and by a lot of the people that have to deal with it, that was somewhat discriminating against the poor who typically go to the state hospitals and don't have access to private hospitals, and it excluded those going to the private hospitals from really falling within this category and being considered under this category, section of the statute.
Okay, and then inpatient placements is something, can you share with us that the interested work parties were signed off on the inpatient placement part?
That's correct.
Okay.
As they read down to that section, there was some concern that we needed to at least elaborate that did refer to the other placements, the other hospital settings besides just, it was
section
just felt
four then it goes on. It's a merely recitation of current law until we get to page four. And I would like to offer a change here on line 20. And I've discussed these with Senator Hanby on the floor this morning. I'd like to delete on line 20 or any peace officer. So that we leave in the words that the mental health program, community mental health program director can designate somebody and the sheriff of the county can designate somebody. Any peace officer, as we've learned in this committee, has a very broad connotation, and there's no indication that a peace officer would necessarily know what to do if someone discharged them to any peace officer. So I think it's important that we know who's going to be in charge here and who is who. So that the mental health professionals know where to call on this issue. So, are there objections to Chair's amendment to delete or any peace officer?
Madam Chair.
Senator Brenneman.
I support that, but for even some additional reasons that places more responsibility on other agencies such as the city police force.
Well, if the sheriff can designate with their approval, at least they can designate someone in Lincoln City to go and do this. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't. You're not just going to be calling up the local Lincoln City police force and say, "Send somebody over to pick this person up and transport him someplace." So that's essential.
Yeah, each city could designate someone then.
Sure. And the sheriff would be in charge of organizing how to put that all together, and I think that's still clearer that it could happen. I don't hear any objections to the chair's amendments. Then I would like to offer removal of section 5. Can we get to section 6? I understand, and I couldn't have a difficulty in locating. This is just the wrong site. Is that what it is, Dennis? It's a cleanup piece from the last.
That's correct. It's 250 deals with Billings. It was meant to be 215.
And 215 is the police officer taking into custody, so that's an appropriate amendment. The chair would suggest that we delete section 7. And now we're left with section 8, and I guess as near as I could gather this morning, that's a substitute for your comments on which was the old section 9 originally, which had to do with some sense of confidentiality. And I need, Dennis, for you to go through section 8 as you recently drafted and tell us what it means and why.
Okay. Actually, this, the various different dash four and I think dash one, there were attempts to modify the original, actually subpart four of section nine in the proposed bill as it began. There was some discomfort with that, in particularly in referencing 192.502. The work session didn't quite know, the parties that sat at the work session didn't quite know what to do with that, had some also their own concerns about 192. It later became, we modified it, I think, under dash four to be 179.505, referenced that. Bob Junda from the Oregon Advocacy Center had kind of haunting remaining difficulties using either one of the two other statutes to try and get at withholding some limited information that might come up in an investigation if the information to be released would constitute a clear or immediate danger to another person and it wasn't going to be used in the court proceeding itself. Actually, it was, I think, about a week and a half ago we came up here and we did meet out in the hall. He had looked at that and...
Now, they are not a line administrator. They are not a line duty manager. And they're advisory to sort of develop something. So I would object strenuously. I want a person and a position in that institution to have the responsibility
of designing it.
Yeah, to get to, and it's their neck if it doesn't get. They can go over there and they can say, we have this team, the team is recommending this, but may I operate the educational piece in this institution, and this is how it's going to have to be. And I think that person ought to be responsible or lose their job or whatever based on that. So I'll argue strenuously in order to leave the bill.
Well, I'm not going to argue strenuously for it.
The way it is. Okay. In the meantime, we have a number of people who come here for public hearings on other bills. Committee's pleasure. The chair has moved Section 5. We probably don't have any debate on that. Are there objections to the addition of Section 5 of the Bryan Amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Shoemaker.
Senator Shoemaker, do you want me to move the bill?
No, or you can move your other
amendment.
No, I'm not. No.
I'm just raising that as a consideration. I'm not wedded to it.
Oh, no.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2214 as amended to the full recommendation.
Senator Hill moves House Bill 2214 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Comments? Discussion.
Madam Chair, are those amendments going to cost more than $133,000 that I already had tagged onto this little critter?
We don't know.
I'll tell you,
it will go for another fiscal, and we'll see what it comes up with.
Okay.
And then we'll hold the bill. Obviously, we don't forward the bill until we find it. We may have it back to strip them out if it turns out to be something different. Call the roll, please, Andrea.
Aye.
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's move to 2257.
House Bill 2257A is at the request of the Indigent Accused Committee of the Oregon State Bar. You would call that John, I believe his last name is Pinkstaff, was here, as well as OCD. OCDLA representative Steve Anderson. This bill is a short one, requires the district attorney to review regulatory instruments in major before they're filed.
And we have no amendments?
There are no amendments.
And no disagreement, at least for the moment.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 2257 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Grinsky has moved Senate Bill 2257 to the floor with a due pass. There are recommendations, discussion. Hearing none, call the roll, please, Andrea.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Grinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Spradlin?
Aye.
Rockman?
Aye.
Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Grinsky? Springer.
Aye.
Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. 2262.
House Bill 2262 is at the request also of the Indigent Accused Committee of the Oregon State Bar. This is the bill having to do with the crime of failure to appear, and it would prohibit the state from calling the defendant's counsel in those cases. As amended by the House, there would be an exception for those cases where, according to their language, no other reasonably adequate means exist. There was some discussion at our hearing regarding amending that language back out. I'll pass out that amendment to you with that drafted for your convenience.
Madam Chair, while Jack is handing that out, I guess I would ask to hear from Jack or someone who's in the criminal courts how the court would, I mean, how is this going to work in real life? I mean, the court's not going to be able to make that determination unless they've heard a substantial body of the evidence. And presumably someone, I guess the court has decided, well, no, there's insufficient evidence, at which point, you know, whoever's defending this individual is going to make a motion to dismiss the case, and then the judge becomes all of a sudden an interested party or has to make some determination as to the sufficiency of the evidence or a witness, and then you continue the trial to subpoena the attorney. I just don't think it's going to work the way the House has amended it in real life.
Madam Chair.
Jack.
The typical situation that I've seen, Senator Springer, is what happens is you represent a client, they disappear and fail to appear at a sentencing or a trial or whatever.
Yeah, I've had a few of those.
A few weeks later, you're in court and they're back on the arraignment docket. They come into court and, quite frankly, if there's even a possibility that the person is going to be charged with failure to appear, which, as an aside, is relatively rarely charged, at least in Multnomah County, the attorney feels compelled to conflict off. With the amendment that the court has included, it's a policy choice, obviously, but my opinion from having seen how this works in the day-to-day courtroom environment is the bill is basically meaningless.
As amended?
As amended, unless that language is taken back out.
Well, that's why you have the amendment here.
Well, Madam Chair, for discussion purposes, I'd move the amendment, which takes us back, I think, to the original language of the bill, and hopefully we'll make it work.
I think it's worth trying, given what we sort of found out in terms of its possible workability in any case as the bill came to us. So, further discussion about Senator Springer's amendments to approve the 2262A2 amendments. Your objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
I move the bill as amended to the floor, do pass.
Senator Springer moves House Bill 2262 to the floor as amended with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Andrea.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Gransky.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. We'll get Senator Springer to move that. Carry that one. 2468 relating to Medicaid fraud.
There are some amendments to this bill. I'll pass those out. In the .468 engrossed is at the request of the Department of the Justice. You'll recall we heard testimony to the effect that this bill does primarily two things. It brings Medicaid fraud into the provisions of the RICO statute. Actually, that's the second thing it does. The first thing it does is change the venue requirements. The purpose of the change is to the net effect is to have most of these cases prosecuted in Marion County, where the claims are submitted by providers. The amendments are also at the request of the Department of Justice, and these basically take care of a drafting error. When the bill was worked on over in the House, the statutory reference to the criminal penalties was was not inserted into the RICO statutes, which it should have been.
Madam Chair, this looks pretty cut and dry. Well, I guess we have an amendment here, don't we?
Yeah, we do need to move the amendments.
Madam Chair. Just a question, staff. So we're including it in the racketeering statute so that the recovery can be made? Is that the point?
So that in those, according to her testimony, relatively rare cases where the false claims are submitted to such an extent that it's warranted, so those providers can be prosecuted under the RICO provisions.
One time, tell me what RICO stands for.
Racketeering and Corrupt Influences Act.
Operations.
Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organization.
There you go.
Thank you.
So Medicaid fraud would now be one of those corrupt organizations aspiring to do that.
To the extent it's not already.
Okay. Do I have a person who'd like to move the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2468? Senator Grinsky moves.
Madam Chair, I'd move dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2468.
Senator Springer.
I just want to make sure that if all of a sudden we're changing the location of the trial for all these medical providers who are stealing from the system to Marion County, we're not going to disproportionately impact the Marion County DA's office. Is there anybody here? Mr. Penn's telling us.
He's waiting for his turn on something else, I think.
I want to be sensitive to the workload here.
Okay.
Other than that, I'm a little concerned about bringing these to Salem. I've never been keen about RICO, so I'm going to be a no on this, but I don't want to hold it up.
Yes, we've had long.
Question I have.
Senator Shoemaker.
I notice in reading the staff summary, it says that Medicaid billing cases can be prosecuted both civilly and criminally, and that this amendment only changes venue for criminal purposes, not for civil purposes. And I wonder if that's something we ought to give any thought to. Do they ever prosecute them civilly? I mean, as a practical matter, does anybody know? Does anybody care? If they do, is there any reason to have the venue? Why should the venue for civil cases not also be in Marion County if that's where the records
it's
are?
It's not an issue of venue. It's an issue of wanting to prosecute them under the RICO Act, which is a different level of fraud, in my opinion.
It's pretty low level, though. It's only talking about Class C misdemeanor, that still brings it under RICO, apparently. So it's pretty petty stuff.
Jack, can you comment?
Well, it's petty in the sense that the claims are usually small, so they are Class C misdemeanors, but what the cases that they're concerned about prosecuting under RICO, obviously, are those where you have quite a number of these petty things, and the aggregate is fairly substantial.
I see, and Are there civil penalties for this that are ever pursued?
I believe the Department of Justice pursues these cases civilly on occasion.
And they're perfectly happy to pursue them.
As I understand the House committee amendments, it was amended specifically just so it would apply to those criminal cases.
Okay.
Are there objections to the amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay.
Madam Chair, move House Bill 2468 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Grinsky moves House Bill 2468 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. We've noted Senator Springer's discussion and anyone else? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
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 Springer. Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, I think we've finished our work session for the day, and we have sent a call in to Representative Bunstaff to deal with House Bill 3099. Why don't we take up 3099 next, then?
In that case, Senator Springer, I mean, could carry that. Now that we think about it,
converts always have more zeal.
We need to keep going the other side. Tracy, won't you go ahead, please?
Okay, thank you. Senator Cohen and members of the committee, my name is Tracy Meyer, and I'm here to testify on behalf of State Representative Stan Bunn in favor of House Bill 3099. House Bill 3099 adds to the definition of rape in the first degree females who are incapable of consent by reason of mental defect or mental incapacitation. These are currently included under rape in the second degree. The House Judiciary Committee also amended the bill to add females that are incapable of consent because of physical helplessness to rape in the first degree. This issue was brought to Representative Bunn's attention as a result of a woman that was a patient in the Oregon hospital who was drugged and raped by a hospital employee on three consecutive nights. Because she was drugged, she was physically unable to say no. Under the present law, the rapist could only be charged with rape in the second degree. House Bill 3099 would allow offenders to be charged with rape in the first degree, which is the highest penalty for rape, when their victim is incapable of consent by reason of mental defect, mental incapacitation, or physical helplessness. Under present law, if the victim is rendered helpless by the attacker, the rapist can be charged with the lower degree of rape. This could be an incentive for the rapist to render his victim helpless with the knowledge that he would be charged with the lower degree of rape. This bill will also allow the mentally ill and others that are unable to say no greater protection of their rights. Representative Bunn feels that House Bill 3099, which proposes amendments to the present Oregon law, would aid in further protecting victims' rights. A rapist should not be charged with a lesser penalty because he rendered his victim helpless or because the victim was mentally incapable of saying no. Representative Bunn urges your passage of House Bill 3099 to the full Senate. Thank you.
Are there questions? Senator Grinsky.
I won't ask this witness that question. Thanks.
Do you, we can track down somebody.
I need to ask Jack, I guess, but wasn't the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the reasoning behind the reduction is the fact that it's possible that the scenario presented by the witness is one thing, but another scenario might be voluntary intoxication on the part of the an alleged victim. And the defendant has legitimate question as to consent. And that, I think, is where you get into a B versus an A felony, is there's a reduced culpability there. Obviously, where the defendant is the one that induces the mental incapacitation or a mental defect, if that's possible, then that's a different deal. And that's what I think the witness's story refers to. But I'm a little concerned about the case. Basically, we're making it the same as, you know, the worst sexual offense possible. And I'm not sure that it rises to that level all the time.
I don't know if Jack's...
I'm not sure what the question is.
Well,
are you asking me if the rationale was originally that?
Right.
It may very well have been have. I don't have any specific knowledge of that. Just like any crime, oftentimes folks don't realize, unless you've really practiced criminal law, one crime can cover a really broad spectrum of acts. And obviously the act that she's spoken to is at one end, and the one you're speaking to is perhaps at another. The only other comment I would make, I guess in a case like that, you would also have the potential of prosecuting someone for a delivery of a controlled substance as well.
Cool.
Well, this is not scheduled for work session today, so if you want to do a little discussing around with DAs and people who prosecute these things, that might be useful to see how it all, to investigate a little bit exactly how, what the range of applicability might be. I guess that's the word we want to look at. We'll check it out. So we have sent for Kevin on the others. Anyone else like to speak to House Bill 3099? Come on up, Dale.
My name is Dale Penn, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I was here on other bills, but we are supportive of this bill. We believe that the numbers of cases is small, so fiscal impact is a small price, I guess, on this bill. However, the category of victims is very important, and I would see the bigger category being the victims who are incapable of consent by reason of mental defect or mental incapacitation. In Marion County, that is a very severe problem. Any county that has mental health group homes, hospitals, that type of thing, we do have victims that are preyed upon. And these are very difficult cases to make. Many times, the incapacitation of the victim also means that they are unable to go into a courtroom and to testify in an appropriate manner, at least in a persuasive manner, to justify a conviction. So they're very small numbers of cases. When we are able to make a case or when you have a confession from a defendant, you want to be able to move forward on it. I think it is appropriate that in most of the situations, at least in my own personal experience that I've dealt with in this kind of case, and I don't know if the case she is referring to is the one that I know of, but we did have a case where a woman was drugged by a hospital technician. She was unable to object to it, but she was aware of it. And this happened to her several times, and we were faced with a problem that we really didn't believe that we could deal with that offender the way that we should under the categories of crimes. I must tell you that in 13 years of prosecution, that's probably only the second physical helplessness case that I've dealt with, but when you have them, they tend to be very severe situations. So the bottom line is we would urge you to support this bill. We don't believe it has a big fiscal impact. It doesn't have large numbers, but when you have a case that fits these definitions, we believe that Class A felony treatment for that offender is justified.
Thank you. Well, Sir Griffin.
Since you're up here, I'm going to ask you this question. If I'm not mistaken, mental incapacitation includes intoxication. Is that right?
Madam Chair and Senator Grinsky, since I wasn't prepared on this bill, I really am not familiar with that definition right now. I know that I've never tried to prosecute one under alcohol. Whether it be possible, I don't know.
What do you mean you've never tried to prosecute one under alcohol? It just diminishes the level of the crime. It doesn't eliminate it, though.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you saying exactly?
I'm saying that we have never prosecuted someone on a rape case where the allegation was without any kind of indicator of physical violence or force, that the allegation was incapacity to consent because of alcohol. But it's probably possible under the statute. I just couldn't answer that.
Well,
I would only respond, as Mr. Morris did originally to your question, was that if that were to go forward and it was theoretically possible under the law to prosecute for rape one, obviously you would have the lesser included crimes, you'd have other crimes that would also be accurate definition of the conduct, and it would be a jury issue on whether or not they believed there was lack of consent and the defendant misinterpreted the situation or took advantage of the situation, and that would be the jury issue.
Well, that's not really an issue under the bill as presented. You're going to be prosecuted for rape, first-degree rape, Class A felony, the most serious of all, if the female, according to the language here, is incapable of consent by reason of mental defect, mental incapacitation, or physical helplessness. It doesn't say the defendant had to be responsible for that. Mm-hmm. So what you've got is a situation where perhaps consent is confused because of these reasons, and you're going to be prosecuted at the highest level versus the way it used to be or the way it presently is unless this passes, and that is the person has expressed they do not wish to engage in sexual activity. Person goes ahead with it anyway. That in the past was the only way you got to that point. Now, mm-hmm. If a person's intoxicated and it's not clear whether consent was given or not, you could still be prosecuted under a rape one.
Okay.
That to me is a pretty big deal.
Jack has a.
There are some definitions of the terms that are used that may take care of some of your concerns. Mentally defective means that a person suffers from a mental disease or defect that renders the person incapable of appraising the nature of the conduct. Physically helpless means the person is unconscious or for any other reason is physically unable to communicate willingness. Mentally incapacitated means that a person is rendered incapable of appraising or controlling the conduct of the person at the time of the alleged offense because of the influence of a controlled or other intoxicating substance administered to the person without the consent of the person, or because of any other act committed upon the person without the consent of the person. So I think that would go to at least some cases where that you're bringing up voluntary intoxication.
With the consent would not, if there was any consent involved in, then it would fall off based on that definition.
Well, we'll
work on it in a work session. We'll discuss it more and we'll figure it around. Let's then move ahead to close the public hearing on
3099
and move Senator Hill. You don't do anything on this one. Representative Maddox is here. This is a 2436, I suppose that's the best one to start with, right?
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix, State Representative for House District 32, which is Central and Northeast Salem. House Bill 2436 started out in the House Judiciary Committee, and I will mention, if I may, that House Bill 2257 is an offshoot of 2436, and perhaps, Madam Chair, with your permission, I can sort of combine my comments on
sure,
both
please
of those.
Do. We'd appreciate that.
2436 was, I will tell you quite bluntly, sort of a hometown bill when I first filed it, and just basically said that people who are released from the correction system should be sent home. But that was when the bill was first filed. After substantial hearings and substantial work with the Board of Parole and the Department of Corrections, 2436 became a vehicle for a policy statement for a statewide correction system in regard to what happens to inmates when they are released from state institutions. And this would include the soon-to-be-built institutions, wherever they may be situated around the state. The problem is, of course, an impact in any given community when there is a prison in that community and there's a tendency of the prisoners upon release to stay in that community. That is a problem that the City of Salem and the Marion County have faced in the past and presently face. This is a problem that other communities will face in the future as these institutions are set up. But the broader policy question is, what do you do with inmates in the state prison system who are going to be temporarily released or released on parole? No one had addressed through legislation that policy question, and by working with the Board of Parole and the Department of Corrections, we came up with a policy statement that really is based on a statewide view of the correction system, an understanding of the need for regionalization of corrections, and a balancing of state and local concerns. House Bill 2436 related to parole, and therefore, in answering that issue, we had to limit that bill to the policy statement for parole. We had to find another bill with a relating clause for corrections because the same answers basically should be given in regard to temporary release. So House Bill 2257 is frankly a gut and stuff on a bill that Representative Burton had filed, and he gave his permission to use his bill as a vehicle to include the same policy statement with a minor modification for temporary release. What you finally have here is a policy statement that inmates who are released from state institutions either on temporary release or on parole should be required as a condition of that release to return to the county where they resided at the time of the commission of the offense for which they were incarcerated. I want to emphasize county there because there's been some question raised about, well, gee, you don't want someone to go back to the same neighborhood or the same city in some circumstances because of old bad environment and so forth. We very carefully chose the term county rather than city or town or whatever or home area because of that to allow flexibility as to the placement of the inmate, but at the same time to have a policy statement that there should be dispersal of inmates upon release. It also balances out their own job opportunities because if they're all situated in given communities, it's going to be difficult to find job opportunities in just a given community. There were, in effect, a series of escape clauses created for all the special considerations that might apply. In terms of temporary release in House Bill 2257, there's one special escape clause, which is any temporary release up to 30 days, which is the old-fashioned concept of temporary release, death in the family, emergency release to go to funerals and so forth. First 30 days, this doesn't apply. It applies only to temporary release for over 30 days. Otherwise, the temporary release provisions are the same as the parole provisions. The only reason there's a difference in the language in these two bills, and it's basically a format change, is two different legislative council worked on these bills, and one decided they preferred to have it in one format, another put it in another format, and as the bills moved through, they just stayed that way. Otherwise, the policy statements are the same, and I'm not suggesting that you need to change the language in either bill because they're consistent as far as the policy statement goes.
Okay, well, I guess I would ask you, do you have a preference personally?
I think
which
that
policy may, you know, because we may very well want to conform them so that even though the temporary leave hopefully will go out of business shortly, that we make sure that we have a choice of the one that's of preference to you. So.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. I think that the language in House Bill 2257 is a bit clearer and easier to read and understand, and the format flows more evenly. I should add that there's one amendment that might be considered, and there's a reference to biological family who can be supportive, and it's been pointed out, and I can't remember if we made that correction in 2257, it certainly was not made in 2436, that there may be adoptive family who will be supportive in a given community, and the person should be able to move in with adoptive family. Use of biological family was just intended to avoid subterfuge, where people will say, well, gee, these are my family, and I feel good about them. But if there was a reference to a biological or adoptive family, I think we'd be in good shape.
Adopted is in 2350.